Well, Shabbat Shalom, everybody. Good morning, and Boker Tov. Today we are talking about the Torah portion that runs from Exodus or Shemot chapter 10 through about the middle of chapter 13. It's called Bo. And because what I do more and more frequently now is go through the entire portion on Friday night and talk about it in some detail, I'm going to tend to take a little bit more, let's say, free-form approach this morning, talk about some of what I think are the really key aspects, of course, as well as some of the other things, and in particular the things that are appropriate today and that have to do with this issue of what it means as we look at coming out of her and whether we... will see, and of course I make no secret, I do believe we will see, at least I pray that we will see it, I know it's going to happen, the question is just when, right, a greater exodus. And in that sense, because we see so many things in the Torah and in Scripture in general, prophetically, that look like bookends, nested brackets, parentheses, and so forth, it's always kind of fun to speculate, think about what the form of that might look like. And I've talked about that a little bit recently. I'll probably at least touch on it again this morning because I think there are some key aspects of this portion, too, that help us in that regard. But where I want to begin is this way. And then we're going to talk about some of the specifics, of course, from the first couple chapters here. There are a lot of folks. I, at least, maybe because of the radio shows that I do, tend to get a lot more feedback. People saying, you know, they're thinking about coming out. A lot of the same questions, because essentially the process is always the same. People begin to realize that they need to wake up, to come to the conclusion that Jeremiah was right, 16:19. We've inherited lies from our fathers. Okay, so now what do we do about that? Oh, hang on a second. Are we getting? I got a hang on just a second here. I see the comment on the screen. Let me see if I've got a problem. Says I got it turned off. Okay, so if there's an echo, I don't think it's coming through me. Okay, so I hear the sound is fine. All right. Had me worried for a second there. So hopefully, Tirza, you can get that that fixed that you're in, because I don't think it was I don't think it was here. You had me worried that maybe I had a feedback loop for a second. All right, so where I was at, there are more and more folks that are beginning to talk, at least, about, all right, I need to come out of her, how do I do that? And that is certainly something that has been addressed a lot of times. Has lots of different aspects to it. You got to come out economically, spiritually, obviously, and ultimately, in terms of what we can more and more readily see coming, it needs to be physical, I think, as well. That doesn't necessarily mean you have to leave the United States or Great Britain or Australia or wherever it is that you may be, but it certainly means that we need to be aware of the fact that there are physical aspects of the coming plagues. Not only in a medical sense, but I think particularly in terms of the big cities. I just wouldn't want to be in the big cities when the power grid goes down. If I can be blunt, and I have been in the past, I think those literally represent a death trap. Now, that doesn't mean that if the place that the creator of the universe has told you to be is somewhere where you might have a little trepidation, I'm going to listen to him, and that's what I would advise. Pray about it and make sure that you're being obedient to what it is that he's telling you individually to do. But as a general rule, there are certainly places that would look better than other places. So, again, lots of folks talking about coming out of her, but to some extent we're overlooking some of the most important aspects of that. Let me start with this little introductory comment. Some of you know, it's been a couple months ago now, Chuck Baldwin, who has the Liberty List, basically, he's put together a move and an attempt to do something that I've been talking about for a long, long time. I'm not saying that he hasn't been talking about it for a long time, too, but I appreciate his high-profile move to say, look, more and more pastors, preachers of any kind of a number of denominations are beginning to realize that a 501c3 license is, in fact, it's a muzzle. It's a leash to another god. It's the essence of what a license is, right? It's permission from some superior authority to do something without which you don't have their permission. They will call it illegal. And literally what a 501c3 is an IRS tax exemption It's not really an exemption in the truest sense, if you understand the meaning of the words, but it's a way of saying, look, my creator is the almighty state. And if you don't believe that, look and see what's on the charter. So I applaud Baldwin and those groups for having put this list together. I get a number of calls. I've had quite a few over the last month or so of people saying, hey, I saw your name on this Liberty Fellowship list, and I'm interested. Tell me a little bit more, so forth and so on. So all of that's good. And in general, what people are thinking about when they look at those lists, and this is the reason why I'm telling the story, is here we're going to find people that are not afraid to talk about some of the real issues. And I'm certainly happy to be included among that number. As you know, we will talk about the law. I'll talk about the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, lots of other dead letters. In other words, things that were once considered the supreme law of the land in America that ultimately don't apply to the peons anymore. Peons generally don't know why. They haven't got a clue as to what's happened to the rule of law. Well, the line I've used for a long time, of course, is, if you believe that the law of God can be nailed to the cross, well, for 1,700 years people have been believing that lie, why would you think, for crying out loud, that a law of man, like a constitution of men, would fare any better? If you can't trust the creator of the universe to keep his promises, what are you preaching? What are you talking about? What are you worshiping? Why are you worried about the First and Second and Fourth Amendments if you don't look at Scripture and say, hey, you know what? By the way, that takes us back to Bo. That's the lesson here. The entire book of Exodus is about essentially two words. Ani Yahuwah. I am who I say I am. I do what I say I will do. I keep my covenants. I am the creator of the universe. Even in the 501c3 churches, you may hear them say, I am the Lord. But of course, that misses a whole lot, doesn't it? That's part of the problem. The chapter here, chapter 10, begins that way. Yahuwah said unto Moshe, go to Pharaoh, Bo, or come into Pharaoh. It just means get up off your duff and do something, go somewhere else. For I have hardened his heart, stubbornized him, as well as the heart of his servants, that I might show these my signs in the midst of them. And then he says something very key, and this is something else I'm going to come back to. That you may tell in the ears of your son and of your son's son and so on what I have done, what I have wrought upon Egypt, my signs that I've done among them. Why? Same reason. He's consistent. That you may know Ani Yahuwah. I am Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now, Moshe and Aaron, and indeed, eventually, Israel did the things that they were told to do, and that's the key. But more important, of course, is the fact that the creator of the universe did what he said he would do. So back to why I started with this introduction about the Liberty Fellowships and so forth. Because lots of people are beginning to realize something's horribly wrong. And in some cases, they're waking up in different ways. They may see, hey, why aren't we keeping Sabbath anymore? They may see, why is it that the law of the land doesn't apply anymore? Why is it the Constitution says we're supposed to have nothing but gold or silver coin to be called currency or money, and we don't even have that anymore? So it's wonderful that people are beginning to wake up in different ways. But what I want to do today is just to focus a little bit on something and say, come on, let's step back. Oh, and by the way, for those that are getting the same questions that I am, how do we help people come out? What do we tell them? Why is it that we do all those Jewish feasts, things? And why aren't we keeping Christmas and Ishtar Sun God Day and all that kind of pagan crap? I chose that term specifically. It's as appropriate as I can get without getting downright crude. Well, because the creator of the universe is who he says he is. And he says, among other places, right here in this portion, do these things. Do them forever, throughout your generations, in all your dwelling places. What about the word forever, don't we understand? People are rightfully concerned about the supreme law of the land. They're rightfully concerned about the fact that, well, if you get this license from Big Brother to preach what he says to preach and to not talk about those other things, just maybe things aren't quite right. Maybe you're serving another god, no question. But that's just part of the story, folks. While I appreciate that there are lots of churches on this list, as you who have listened here regularly by now know, this one is quite a bit different from the waste stream, even of those that are non-501c3. Because we're going to talk about what's written. And we're going to do the very best we can, although we do connect the dots. It's impossible to be human and not connect the dots, not to want to draw the connections. But we want to do the very best we can not to add to or subtract from what is written in the sense of saying, thus speaks Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh. We'll let him speak for himself. Even in the book, it distinguishes, and interestingly it does in this portion too, between when Yahuwah spoke to Moshe saying, quote, and then you could put these words in red, do this or do that. Speak to Pharaoh and say this. Speak to the children of Israel and say that. Sometimes it's just Moshe saying, here's what he told me. Now, that's a paraphrase as opposed to the literal. So I'm going to do the very best I can to make it clear when we're quoting and when we're connecting dots. And again, I make no apologies. It's impossible, I think, to even translate the original Hebrew into another language, any other language, without doing that to some extent. But we at least just have to be honest about it. And so that's why I don't say, you must do this or you must do that. I'm going to tell you as best I can what the Creator of the universe says we ought to be doing. If you love me, keep my commands. And then let folks do the best they can to interpret, study for themselves, show themselves approved, and then go do what he says as best they can in the context of what we can today. And admittedly, sometimes that's not easy. All of this is important and timely, I think, today in particular, because we just finished up one of the most paganized times of the year, the so-called holiday season, that isn't really holy so far as the Creator of the universe is concerned at all. Ironically, in this portion, he tells us, let this be a beginning of months to you. The springtime, Abib, the time when they're fixing to come out of the land and be free again. People get confused about that. Well, it's no wonder. I think that's deliberate. We are entering a great time to draw this distinction and to be able to answer some of these questions, to give account for the things that we believe. And I'm sure people will ask. And I've already alluded to, well, you know, why are you keeping these Jewish things? Answer, because they're not. It's great. I have no problem with people who are Jewish or people who are of any of the other 12 tribes saying, you know, these are things that Yahuwah told me to do, or these are things that Hashem told me to do and my people to do. Great. And you can even claim that those feasts are yours. I have no problem with that. But the problem becomes when we start saying that they're not his. And that's how I would answer those that say, why are you keeping these Jewish feasts? Because they're not really Jewish feasts. They're the feasts of Yah. They're the feasts of the Creator of the universe. They're his feast. He says it over and over and over again. I don't have to be Jewish to see and understand that when the Creator of the universe tells me to keep something that's his, well, it's his first. Those that want to lay claim to it, great. But let's not blur the lines, and let's not start thinking that therefore they're only Jewish feasts. I do have a problem with that misunderstanding. And that's why all of this is important. Because you can't be talking about liberty and why do we don't have the First and Second and Fourth Amendments anymore? Why don't we have this? If we don't understand, it's because we're not listening to anything. If we can't keep the so-called law, by the way, it's the instruction, right, of Moshe, the things that our Creator says to do forever, well, how could we possibly hold some cretin of a politician responsible for merely breaking an oath that he took before a God that he's never bothered to read any more than he's read the Constitution? I'll point out one more thing on this subject of licensing, because there's a lot of these fellowships, and I think people are moving in the right direction, so don't get me wrong. That's a good thing. It's just that we've still got a long ways to go, all of us. You may hear, in fact, on occasion, some discussion from various pulpits across America about maybe abortion, particularly this week, and I certainly think that that's worth addressing. Thou shalt not murder is still a key line. And maybe we'll talk a little bit about some of the legalism there and how it is that people have been deceived. But this portion, too, points out one thing. Who is to be master? Is it Pharaoh? Or is it the Creator and author of Scripture? Ani Yahuwah, him and him alone. You can't serve both. So I get irritated when I see that the Well, it seems, as I look at the press and I read the things that are getting all the PR, and I listen to some of the very well-known conservative or libertarian talk show hosts that will call themselves Christian and so forth, they'll talk about certain aspects of what's happening, but they won't give people the whole truth. And arguably that's, again, because we've all inherited lies from our fathers. One that I can't help but think about in the context of licensing is marriage. Oh, you're not married, right? You're living in sin, you're shacked up, until such point as you go get a license from Caesar. Huh? Where does it say that? Nowhere. There's nowhere in Scripture. I defy you. Find it. Show it to me, please. Where any man of Yah ever goes and gets a license, has a blood test, waits 3 days, and then goes to the justice of the peace to solemnize his relationship. We talk about this frequently. The point is, it doesn't happen. It's the father, father of the bride, father of the groom, and the father that are the only other folks that are involved in permission-oriented aspects of marriage. We don't need a license, in other words, to happen. What we need is covenant, offer and acceptance, agreement to make this commitment. And then once that thing is consummated, there's a marriage, whether people like it or not. We got a whole lot of people with a lot more husbands and wives running around, or husbands and whoring, or adulteresses, or however you want to put it. There's a whole lot more stuff going on in the United States than most people understand or are willing to deal with. So this week I heard one of those so-called conservative politicians talking about marriage, how important it is. Oh, see, we're talking about licensing gay marriage. That's wrong, because we license the kind of marriage. No, we don't. What's the word that is used? What is the word that this politician, who I'm not going to name, will constantly employ? It's what you'll see in the press. You don't see him talking about biblical marriage, in other words, right? Say it with me, folks. Traditional marriage. We want bull! I could care less about traditional marriage. Hey, they're making man lying with man as with a woman. Traditional. It don't make it biblical. It don't make it, and I'm being a little bit colloquial, because I come from Missouri, where we speak Southern, it don't make it right. It might even make it legal, but it does not make it lawful in accord with the author and creator of Scripture and the one who defined marriage. It is. It's about who is to be master. That is all. So there's a long introduction that basically says, look, we've fallen just as much into the same kind of slavery, whether we know it or not, that these people in ancient Mitzrayim in Egypt had. Oh, well, we don't have to make bricks without straw. Well, you're getting ready to find out what it is to make a peanut butter and jelly sandwich without peanut butter or bread, because the economy is melting down in spite of the lies we're being told about the state of the disunion. Let's focus for a second on the specifics, and the reason why I'm headed in this direction as we talk about this this book, and in particular this Parsha Bo, the last three plagues, if you will. And, of course, in order, we know what they were. We've talked about the first seven last time. This week, we're going to get the plague of locusts. Certainly one of the most famous plagues. It makes for great TV or movie footage, right? Because there's something unique about it. If you don't let my people go, says Charlton Heston, tomorrow I will bring locusts into your borders. They're going to cover the whole face of the earth. They're literally going to darken the land. And anything that hadn't been whacked already by the previous plagues, well, they're going to eat every little shred of green that is left. You can count on it. Even Pharaoh's servants, who have been beginning to wake up and thinking about coming out themselves, I tend to suspect some of them ended up leaving the land, walking out on foot with Moshe. They ask Pharaoh, how long is this man going to be a snare to us? Come on, let these folks go, for crying out loud. Can't you see? Egypt has been destroyed. They're speaking truth to the power. They're telling him, hey, your State of the Union message here, it's bogus. Dude, wake up. Well, the locusts come, and literally, there is darkness. They cover everything. Ain't seen nothing like it before. Won't see anything like it ever after. Let's pause there for a second, because the point that I want to make as we do just a brief intro to the plague aspects of this is that we're going to see three plagues, and they all have something kind of key in common, and that is that they have a lot to do with darkness. The locusts literally darken the land. But that's not enough. When we get to Exodus 10:21, the next plague, now we're going to see darkness, the kind of deep darkness which, and I love this metaphor, Scripture really puts it viscerally, doesn't it? Even darkness which may be felt. Thick darkness for 3 days. Except, of course, where this distinction has been made. Where Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh puts a distinction between the people of the land of Mitzrayim, Egypt, and of Israel. His folks, they had light in their dwellings. And then you come to the death of the firstborn. We'll talk about that just a teeny bit more here in a second. When does it take place? It takes place in the middle of the night. I think the key of darkness is interesting to me. And I've mentioned this, so I'll lay it out here again as we get kind of into this in a little bit more depth. Because when I look ahead at the United States, and indeed the Western world, and I see the threats that are out there and the kind of things that people are being lied to, looks to me like darkness is descending. Matter of fact, I saw a quote. It's not a quote from a fellow that I have that much admiration for, but it certainly is a little bit interesting. William O. Douglas, talking about the dire state of the Union and how things happen. Now, again, this is out of context, but I think it was a cute quote. As nightfall does not come all at once, neither does oppression. In both instances, there's a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged. And it is such a twilight that we must all be most aware of change in the air, however slight, lest we become unwitting victims of the darkness. And, of course, people like he and other so-called just us's have, in fact, been instrumental in leading a nation into that kind of darkness. And yet, if the plagues that I think are being, you could say prophesied, but how about just laid out for us, that we're being warned about, include darkness. Probably the single most likely thing that I suspect will usher in what is coming is a major power grid failure in the United States. We've been warned about a half a dozen different ways that it could happen. Could be a nuke from any number of sources. North Korea, China, Iran, Russia, fill in the blank, any number of other folks. Could be CMEs coming from the sun, an act of God, if you will. And it certainly could be a cyber attack. We've seen lots of those as well. Okay, I got a question on the screen. What I'm going to do is put that on hold, save it, and we'll come back to it about divorce. Because it is something that we've talked about a lot in the past, so I will take that and we'll come back to it. So if you can hang on, Tirza, I'll address that. There is, in fact, well, I'll give you the easy answer now, and we'll come back to it in more detail. It's in Deuteronomy 24, verses 1 to 3. He tells us precisely the process. So Deuteronomy 24, 1 through 3, it's repeated twice, interestingly. Makes it very clear. But again, we'll come back to that. The point, of course, is that there is a process, and there are things that are recorded in the instruction that we have. It's just that it's not necessarily what we've been told, and of course, like so many other things, we have been lied to about that as well. These three plagues have this idea of darkness in common with them. Now I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. Just make a couple of other points. Chapter 12 of Exodus, Shemot 12:12, is a key to this. When the final plague, the death of the firstborn, is being described, and it's laid out here. And by the way, the instructions are laid out too. Here's what you're going to do. You're going to go get a lamb for the house, according to the number of the folks in the house. A male of the first year without blemish, can be from the sheep or from the goats. Keep it from the 10th day to the 14th day. And the whole assembly of Israel, the congregation, the kahal, is to kill it, koledat, at dusk. Take the blood, put it on the side posts and on the lintel of the house. So there are some specific instructions about what it is that they're to do. Here's the thing I want to focus on. Verse 12:12 says, I, this is Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh speaking, will go through the land of Egypt in that night, and I will smite all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, Mitzrayim, both man and beast. And then he says the following, against all of the Elohim of Israel, of Egypt, will I execute judgments. And then he signs it, Ani Yahuwah. I am who I say I am. And then here's the key. This day shall be unto you for a memorial. You shall keep it as a feast, as a moed. I like that term in this thing too. It's a set-apart day. To Yahuwah, throughout your generations, you're to keep it by a feast forever, by an ordinance, as a feast forever. And then he goes through how it's going to work. 7 days, eat unleavened bread. On the first and on the seventh day is a holy, a set-apart convocation. No manner of servile work, but you can cook, you can do things that you're needing to do to eat. Observe this feast. Don't let any leaven be in your house. As an ordinance throughout your generations forever. Chochat Olam. And he says that several times in here. Three times in less than about 15 verses. So let me ask this as a question. Right, in all of the Liberty Fellowships, all of the Christian places that might say, okay, let's talk about the First Amendment or the Second Amendment, or let's talk about abortion, how often do we hear preached all of these things that the Creator of the universe says we're to do, keep forever throughout your generations and all your dwelling places? How often are people hearing that? How often are they hearing he says, I don't like your fake things, your new moons, your so-called holy days that aren't, your Ishtar sun god day, your sunrise services, your Christmas holiday that isn't. At the same time where you're saying these things that I told you, all of Israel, to keep forever, teach your sons, 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 we're not doing. And then we wonder why it is that the First and the Second Amendment and the Fourth Amendment don't apply. And why we can say that the law is done away with, and why we're surprised when we're not doing the things that he says, keep, do, by an ordinance, throughout your generations, forever. So I've suggested for quite a while, I started doing this long before I began teaching any of this, because it caught my attention. This word forever, right? Somebody asked me, another teacher once asked me, well, when do you think forever is? When did God decide to quit lying in his book? I know, it's at that the little divider that says New Testament, Old Testament. Everything on this left side is a lie. All the new things are the things he says to do. He must have just changed his mind because he's fickle, he can't be trusted. Who's kidding who, right? If you believe that, if you believe the foundations can be destroyed, well, what can the righteous do? So I suggest that folks take and highlight. When you go through your scripture, when you're reading, and you'll find a bunch of places in this book. You'll find a lot of them in Exodus, a whole lot of them throughout the Torah, but especially here in Deuteronomy where there's a great repetition of this. He says, keep, do, forever. Highlight it. And ask folks, why aren't we doing that anymore? Well, because some guy with a funny hat said, don't do it anymore. He heard from God. He called God up on the phone and said, God, you made a stupid mistake here. Don't do that anymore. If we're hearing stuff like that, folks, somebody's lying to us. And hint, hint, it's not the Creator of the universe who's the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow. They quote that verse, but then they don't tell you what it means. Or Malachi, I change not. This is so important. I mean, as we look at this, this whole book, this whole chapter of the book, where it tells us to do these things. And what's the point? So you can teach your children, speak these things into your children's ears. Later on, he gives us some questions. Says when your child asks you, here's what you're to tell him. Chapter 13. You shall tell your son in that day. Why are we doing this stuff, Dad? Of this thing, which Yahuwah did for me when I came forth out of Mitzrayim. Well, you didn't come forth out of Mitzrayim. Your great, 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 who knows how many greats? Granddaddy or uncle or somebody did. We're still supposed to have learned the lesson. And the point that I'm trying to make is, as vociferously as I can, is we ain't learned the lesson. We got a bunch of liars that have been licensed by another god to tell us things that are not true and to say things that are done away that he says are never going to be done away with so long as heaven and earth still exist. Somebody's lying. If we want to come out of her, if we really want to understand what's wrong with our system of law, why it is that it's not law anymore, it starts with understanding the little things that aren't so little, the things that he says to do, to keep, to teach. It begins with teaching our children. And I like a little part of the Midrash. I mentioned this last night. One of the sages says, why does it say don't just tell them? It says to put these things into your children's ears. And essentially the understanding there is, you know what? I don't care even if you think they're too young to understand. Do it anyway. Because, and I this is the way I read it, children are like little sponges. Even before they can speak, even before they seem to have comprehension, trust me, folks, they are absorbing words. Their little brains are, well, wonderfully made. They're putting all this stuff inside there. And it's being stored up like a great big sponge of knowledge. And later on, it's going to come back out. They're going to put it together. They're going to learn to connect the words, make their own connections, connect their own dots. And it's important that all the right stuff be in there to begin with and that they be taught all of this stuff. You know what? It's stuff that, sadly, we weren't taught. That's part of the reason why we live in a world that's such a mess. And we're having to learn it later. And it's harder to learn it when you're 25 or 40 or 60 than it would have been when you were 18 months. And your daddy says, this is very important. This is why we do what we do. Because the creator of the universe is who he says he is. And he has brought us out of bondage by a mighty hand. And you know what? Because we haven't learned that lesson, we're in worse bondage now. And we don't even know it. The ignorance, the darkness is so deep that if you look at the State of the Union message, folks, you can feel it. It's a permeable darkness. Upon all the gods of Egypt will I execute judgment. He said it then. I believe firmly we're going to see it again. Let me mention one other thing, just to be at least more or less complete concerning this idea of the death of the firstborn. It is it's a very important thing. There's almost unanimous agreement, it would seem, again, among the sages, that it was this that resulted in the true redemption of Israel. In other words, all of these acts of taking up the gods of Egypt one by one, yeah, you think the Nile River's a god? Let me show you. You think frogs are god? Lice, whatever, pick one. Let me show you. We get to the point where Pharaoh is essentially implying, say some of the folks, Ra, the sun god, is the greatest of the gods of the pantheon of Egypt. And so the last three plagues all have to do with dissing the sun god. Locusts darken the sky during the daytime and the ground. And then we have real darkness that darkens the day and the night so deep that you can feel it. And finally, when does the death of the firstborn happen, bringing things full circle? Middle of the night. I like this line. I'm going to quote a couple of lines from a piece by Rabbi Ari Kahn called Around Midnight. The personal, hands-on involvement of the Creator of the universe in the redemption of these verses that are described here as the tenth plague unfolds. Well, all of these things are how the sages put together the idea that the redemption is due to this plague, the tenth plague, the death of the firstborn, and no other alone. Because Pharaoh, basically, isn't going to let folks go until the Creator of the universe is completely finished with him. Now, interestingly enough, there are some specifics about this particular plague that are a bit different. I mentioned this idea of, and Yahuwah spoke to Moshe saying, and then we get the words in red. Well, in this case, it's a bit different, because here, it's paraphrased. Moshe quotes, and he says, here's what Elohim Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh told me to do. And yet, the instructions about this tenth plague, the death of the firstborn, were given to Moshe even before he began his journey back to Egypt to confront Pharaoh. And this comes from Shemot or Exodus chapter 4, 21 through 23. Elohim said to Moshe, when you return to Egypt, you can do all these wonders before Pharaoh, which I have put in your hand, but I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. And you are to say to Pharaoh, thus says Elohim, Israel is my firstborn, my son, and I say to you, let my son go that he may serve me. And if you refuse to let him go, behold, I will slay your son, your firstborn. Once again, what we're seeing here is this is a creator who keeps his promises. He lays these things out. If you refuse, the warning is given too. Behold, I will slay your son, your firstborn. And the sages essentially say, look, here is what's really happening. Remember this man Moshe? Pharaoh, literally years before, wanted him dead. Among all kinds of other young babies, males. The intent was that the Pharaoh intended to murder all of the young Hebrew infant males. You'll hear the term measure for measure. He was given Pharaoh a chance. I guess you could call that real justice, to repent. He blew it. Pharaoh, who is this Yahuwah? I know him not. He made his own bed and he's going to lie in it. But nevertheless, here's another set of brackets that's not completed. Until the measure for measure, till the death of the firstborn is done. And it is that one that really results in the redemption of all of Israel. After he has executed judgment over all the gods of Egypt and showed who he was. Now there's one other aspect to this that I want to make sure we mention, just because it, I think, is real key in putting all these pieces together, helping us to connect the dots. When does the death of the firstborn happen? In the darkness, in the middle of the night. And yet, they're ready to go. They're going to be thrust out, but a little bit of time happens. Once they're finally told, they leave in the morning. So I'll read this paragraph. Again, this is that same author, Rabbi Ari Kahn, says, the first act of freedom, therefore, was choosing not to leave Egypt when Pharaoh told them to do so. Remember, they were told, don't leave your homes at night. And they exercised their right as a free people, how's that for an interesting turn of phrase, to obey the word of Elohim and not the word of Pharaoh. They marched out of Egypt at an hour when the sun god was up doing his thing. They left in daylight, heads held high, and the vanquished Egyptian gods had been put aside. And there's another aspect to this that I think is key too. I've quoted William Penn a lot of times. Those who will not serve God will serve tyrants. Choose this day whom you will serve. Whether people like to acknowledge it or not, folks, we've been designed to serve our Creator. We're free to make a choice not to. But it turns out, my understanding, this is the markology for today, is that if we choose not to serve Him, we're going to end up serving something worse. Take your pick. Maybe it's the God you see in the mirror. That's what you'll hear from most politicians anyway, if they were honest, and they're not. But on the other hand, really what it means is that there's just some other God, adversary, you know, pick a name, Hasatan, Lucifer, Beelzebub, Cthulhu, Molech, you name it. The God of self, Mammon, you know, there's all kinds of things. But ultimately, it all boils down to the same thing. There's a way that seems right to a man. Their end thereof is the way of death. So what I'm trying to suggest to you here is we have this interesting be ready, get your staff in your hand, get your sandals on your feet, be ready to go. Because at the moment when you are no longer serving Pharaoh, we need to be ready to be gone, going to get out of here in daylight and go serve Yah. Obviously, they got a ways to go before they get there. But at least the transition needs to be quick. Needs to be immediate. All right, I'm going to come back. We'll come back to the legal system issue because I do think that's a good point. It fits well today. So we've got those questions hopefully saved, and we'll return to that. But what I want to do at least a bit is talk about some of the other things going on in the news and make a couple of related points. I'm going to start a bit differently than I originally intended to because I mentioned this. This was the 42nd anniversary this week. January 22nd, 1973, of one of the worst, and even the legal scholars that I know that would call themselves quote-unquote pro-choice will admit that Roe v. Wade was a crappy decision when it comes to, they didn't even do a very good job of trying to point out what they were accomplishing. In other words, they're basically throwing bricks at the written law and the Constitution and creating new rights out of whole cloth, right? A right to privacy. And yet, think about it, folks, here a bunch of years later, the only right to privacy that a woman has is to abort a baby that's in her womb. She goes to an airport? Does she have a Fourth Amendment right against illegal search and seizure? Can they grope her breasts, x-ray her, check out what she's got underneath her girdle? You bet. Don't give me this, it's my body, I can control it, BS, because you don't. Those blue glove guys are going to rape you and rape your children. And they could care less about your privacy. So what's happened? The lie has been revealed. It's a license to kill that's being talked about here. And it's being extended, too. Was the first trimester, now it's the third trimester, and we've got people openly talking about, well, we're going to abort children as old as we want to. 40? Yeah, well, we've aborted quite a few of those of late. We just need an excuse. We don't even need due process. Don't even need the pretense of two witnesses or of evidence. We just declare them to be, in Nazi Germany, it was a non-person. Hey, come to think of it, that's the same terminology that's used here. You see the point? This is why Roe v. Wade is such a crappy piece of trash. Because the concept was to say, well, literally, we're going to define when human life begins. How is that anything if not an act of playing God? Just so we're complete here, if you remember the case, it was a Texas state law that banned abortion except to save the life of the mother. And they ruled, this is what's, in hindsight, it's hilarious, isn't it? They ruled that the law was unconstitutional. They cited the First Amendment. Isn't that funny? Does any of that still exist? Ha ha. The Fourth Amendment? What? Fourth Amendment, that's the same one that talks about no warrant shall issue. We don't need a warrant anymore. The Ninth Amendment and the 14th Amendments. And get this, again, the 14th Amendment, they claim that it was a due process right to privacy that they're protecting. And I'm going to suggest to you, I dare you, defy, show me otherwise, that any other right to privacy exists in police state 21st century America except the right to kill an infant within a woman's body. You can rape her. You can disarm her so that she can't prevent herself from being raped. You can take away her Second Amendment right to protect herself. You can take away her Fourth Amendment right to speak about it. You can take away her... You can take away anything. You can take away her very life, her property, or his, or anybody else's, for that matter. You can tap. You can wiretap. You can x-ray through the walls of a house. You can do anything you want. You can grope. You can pilfer. You can full spindle mutilate. What right to privacy does any American have, or indeed anybody in the world? None whatsoever. Except that one little license to kill. How sick, how beyond not funny is that? Yeah, the bottom line here is simple. The Roe v. Wade decision is probably about the worst one of the worst. We got a whole bunch of really nasty ones in the last few years, so I'll admit that's a tall order. But one of the worst distortions of the rule of law since Dred Scott. And most people will say, well, Dred Scott, that was a pre-Civil War, Civil War era kind of a decision that, again, ruled who was entitled to life, liberty, and property, who was human and who wasn't. And think about it, folks. I've had this discussion with people. They don't like it because if we'll step back, a lot of libertarians, oh, I'm a libertarian. I support the right of a woman to choose. Well, great. And some of those same folks, at least they're consistent. They'll support her right to choose to bear arms and to choose other things. But those rights don't exist. The Supreme Court won't recognize that under the 14th Amendment. We've got a whole bunch of people that are playing God and they're twisting the law to the point where literally it doesn't mean what the words say it means. Right? To quote Humpty Dumpty and Lewis Carroll, a word means what I want it to mean, nothing more, nothing less. It's about who is to be master, that is all. Now, I may come back and talk about personhood, because one of the other big fallacies you'll hear today is the personhood amendment. We're going to fix Roe v. Wade. How are we going to do that? Well, answer, all you really have to do is go to Article 3, Section 2, Clause 2 of the Constitution and see, you know, it's kind of like the Good Witch Glinda telling Dorothy, you've always had the power to return home anytime you wanted. There's no place like home. All you had to do, Congress, is just tell the Supreme Court, you blew it, dudes. You do not have any more authority to rule on fill in the blank, anything we say. In other words, the Constitution, Article 3, Section 2, Clause 2, gives the Congress the authority to define the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. They could have said 30 years ago, you don't have anything to say about abortion, period, anymore. You're worried about partial birth abortion? We're telling you. You got nothing to say about it. And they'll do it in other areas. And you know, but again, to do that would reveal the depth of the lie. And that's part of the reason why you're not seeing it. So when people talk instead and say, well, we need to have a personhood amendment that defines when life begins, my response is, are you kidding? How stupid are you? Seriously, you're going to play God and define when life begins, or is it not already clear? Because at the point where you say that you have the authority to define when personhood begins, I guarantee you, so did Adolf. So did Pol Pot. So does Barack. So do any number of people. And they're going to define it the way you don't like it. Because you, nor they, have the power, nor the authority to do that. Any more than you can define marriage. And we're seeing the same evil cesspool and where that leads. Either the rules are what the creator of the universe said they were, and you're not to add to them or subtract from them. Or else, as Jefferson pointed out, we enter into this field that is no longer susceptible to any definition, where they'll just twist the whole stinking mess and play God. We'll come back to some of that in a second. Got some other things. Here's where I want to go next. Let's talk a little bit about the other things this week. We had two other big pieces of news. One of them came out of the Eurozone, where the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, did something that he has been pressured to do for a long time, and that, of course, is to print, 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 print. Eurozone QE. They announced $1.1 trillion, as a matter of fact, new euros going to be printed in 18 months. Isn't that grand? No wonder the Swiss decided they wanted to be cut loose, and they unleashed a black swan on the markets. The repercussions of all of that are still playing out, but more and more people are beginning to realize, hey, this is it, folks. Let me just quickly quote the man who predicted 52 days ago, that's actually more like 55 days ago at this point, the collapse of the euro versus the Swiss franc. This is Egon von Greyers of Matterhorn Asset Management, saying that they still believe money printing can save them. It's not going to happen. When it becomes clear that this new money printing program is a failure too, the ECB will do what? More of the hair of the dog. They'll print more. The result will be even more chaos. And then he comes out and makes a prediction that others have made, but I think it's great to see more and more people on board with this. They're going to have to continue the process. The Swiss National Bank is still sitting on a whole bunch of Swiss francs and an unrealized loss of about 80 billion Swiss francs worth of euros. So they're going to have to sell those eventually. And when they find the need to do that, when they start doing it and buying Swiss francs, it's going to strengthen the franc still more. It's a vicious circle. Things get really ugly. So, bottom line, he said, quote, "This is why the financial system will not survive," unquote. And then he goes on to say, "A total global collapse is now in front of us." I'm going to make a prediction of my own. Not surprising. We've already seen all of this essentially laid out. At the point where the global financial system collapses, World War III is probably already started, right? It'll be made more obvious. People need to be distracted. When their 401k collapses and their money is worthless and the shelves at Walmart and the local grocery store are empty, something else has got to happen so that we don't get blamed for it. What would be good? I know. Maybe a total power grid failure. Or World War III, or all of the above. The State of the Union was the other so-called news this week. And I'll spend a minute or two talking about some aspects of that, just because, again, I think they fit with Bo and the fact that one by one these gods are being held up and ridiculed. But I like this one because, maybe you could say this is the creator of the universe already doing this. I certainly think he has a hand in this. But I like this. This story came out. As you probably are aware, this week the movers and shakers of the world, the CEOs and the people who see God when they look in the mirror, have descended on the mountain town of Davos, Switzerland. I saw the number. Over 1,700 corporate jets flew into Davos this week for the big confab. And here's how Reuters puts the real state of the union. The headline says, "A year of disasters sinks trust in business and government. The year of disasters and mismanagement that was 2014 included everything from mystery air crashes, hacked data and computer systems, foreign exchange rate rigging." Hey, remember LIBOR, the gold market scandals, you name it, they've rigged it. "And the worst Ebola outbreak ever," all of which have, and not to mention Fukushima, and I could list a dozen other things. Libya, fast and furious fallout, because they're still lying about all of those scandals, and you name it. Anyway, all of that has torpedoed global trust in government, public bodies, and business, says a new survey out this week for Davos by the Edelman Trust, called the Edelman Trust Barometer, showed a sharp decline in trust across the board, with faith in governments, business, media, and NGOs, that's the Unholy Alliance, the public-private partnership, non-governmental organizations, has fallen below 50% in two-thirds of the major countries out there, nations like U.S., Japan, Germany, France, Britain, Italy, Russia, and Turkey. And this is particularly stark news for all of those business leaders convening there to discuss how they're going to handle you proletariat, you peons, you new serfs, you in the future. Interesting. Related story, we'll do this one because I think it's got a piece from the Guardian out of the UK. Now, this is a very leftist piece, but it's funny. It's funny just because it shows, on the one hand, how people can have this doublethink in their brains. They see the contradictions and they don't realize that they're still drinking from the same bottle. "Escalating inequality," it says, "is the work of the global elite." And so the headline is correct. So is this one. "The Davos oligarchs are right to fear the world they've made." Now listen to this and hear the blatant contradictions in one paragraph. "The billionaires and corporate oligarchs meeting in Davos, Switzerland this week are getting worried about inequality. It might be hard to stomach that the overlords of a system that has delivered the widest global economic gulf in human history should be hand-wringing about the consequences of their own actions." And then the funny thing is, what they're going to do is they're going to drink the Kool-Aid. Are they really worried about inequality? Oh, do you really believe that? No, folks. This is where the author doesn't get it. They're not worried about the inequality at all. They know exactly what they're doing. What they're worried about is the exposure. Will the peons realize it while they can still do something about it? And until we get them all properly disarmed and chained so that there's no choice but to march down towards feudalism 2.0. I'm going to suggest that it's probably already too late. But at least there are a few of these so-called self-styled progressives or socialists that are waking up and saying, oh, we worry about inequality. They prattle about inequality. Guess what? They could care less. Here's an example. Unilever chief executive Paul Pullman frets about the capitalist threat to capitalism, unquote. Now I'm going to let that fester for a second while I quote Christine Lagarde, the IMF managing director. She fears, quote, capitalism might indeed carry Marx's seeds of its own destructions and warns something needs to be done. I guarantee you the one thing that is not going to be done, folks, is a return to biblically correct, even constitutional, kasef, silver, honest weights and measures. In other words, the funny thing is this. These people use words like capitalism, and they don't have a clue what it is they're talking about. Because if you do not have honest weights and measures, if you don't have an honest money system, if people do not give value for value, all we've got here is institutionalized worldwide theft. They'll tell you it's capitalism and it's free markets. It's bull. There's nothing of the sort. You cannot deceive somebody and pay something to somebody that isn't money and then say that what's happened has been an honest exchange. And that's what those of us that are waking up and realizing, hey, if we're going to deal with our brothers honestly, we've got to start somewhere, have been doing. All right, one last line from this piece. The scale of the crisis has been laid out by Oxfam. Just 80 individuals, they point out, now have the same net worth as 3.5 billion of the world's people, half of the entire global population. And the richest 1% pretty soon are going to own more than all of the other 99% put together. I suspect that it's probably already true because there's control that does not require ownership, right? If you don't own your own bodies, what are we even talking about? The 1/10th of 1/10th of 1%, 1% of 1%, have been doing even better, quadrupling their share of the U.S. income since the 1980s. Again, we're talking about feudalism 2.0. Now, here's where the lie continues. This is a wealth grab, says the Socialist Guardian, on a grotesque scale. They quote the Bank of England governor, Mark Carney, who says that for 30 years, market fundamentalism has been prevailing. No, it's not. Again, how can you have honest markets or anything that you'd call market fundamentalism if you don't have honest weights and measures, an honest money system? And now the richest of the rich are using austerity programs worldwide to help themselves to an even larger piece of the pie. So what does the Guardian think is required? Well, of course, more progressive taxes, yes. More income redistribution. Oh, really? How's it been working out for you so far? And then they even say, look, here we had Obama. There's a wall of resistance to Obama's mild redistributive taxation proposals. People have been duped, literally idiots. They believe that people who don't honor their oaths, and when the rule of law doesn't mean what it says it means, that they can be trusted to redistribute. Their lips are moving. Look and see what they've been doing. All right, here's a question on the screen. This one does fit here nicely, so we'll do it immediately because it's easy, from Tirza. How then do you suggest we purchase something from our brother? Answer, honest weights and measures. Give value for value. At least offer value for value. What the Bible calls real money is silver. In the Hebrew, in other words, the word silver and the word money are the same, kasef. And in the United States, nothing but gold or silver coin is what the law said shall be made tender in payments of debts. Article 1, Section 8, talks about powers that are delegated. It's the power to coin money, not to print it. So, how do we do it? Well, barter is one way. You can obviously say, look, I've got this horse. I'll trade you my horse for your milk cow, or whatever it may be. And failing that, you can say, I'll give you an honest weight of something. And the problem, of course, is that dollars aren't that. Now, what you're going to find is most people, having been brought up in the kind of ignorance that the Guardian is talking about here, they don't know what capitalism is. They don't know what free markets are. They think that somehow or other market fundamentalism is what's going on in the world. No, it's a great big whopper of a lie that the entire world's money system built on a fake. There is no honest money in the world that is a national currency at this point. Not one. As far as I know, up at least in the last 1,000 years, that is unique in human history. So, what I try to do is at least offer somebody real money. Would you like me to pay you with this piece of paper or with this silver quarter? Oh, I want the piece of paper. Well, okay, don't say I didn't warn you, right? At least the person was offered an opportunity to choose something real. And if they don't choose it, hey, you can't force them. That's fine. Let them make their own choices. But we need at least the best we can to try to learn to deal with one another honestly. So I think essentially as we come out of her, more and more I'm going to encourage folks, understand that we at least need to make the effort. Yeah, I know. It's been engineered so that it's hard. Exactly. Okay, follow-up question. Will we then have to use dollars, or what now passes for them, to purchase the gold or silver so that we're not dealing falsely? Ideally, yeah. If you can still get the if you can get the fake stuff right now and swap it for the real stuff, why wouldn't you want to get as much of the real stuff as you can, especially if the price of the real stuff has been made cheap in terms of the fake stuff? So, yeah, you've probably got some of the dollars, and get it while the getting's good. I see the other comments on the screen there about people wanting to live off the land and grow, and we're stuck and so forth. That's a continuing concern. I understand that concern. We pray about that frequently, too, that people would be able to make the moves that they know that they need to make. I guess ultimately what we're talking about is just who is to be master, that is all. Are we going to listen to Pharaoh and believe Pharaoh, or are we going to go and do what it is that the creator of the universe says? We're rapidly approaching the point. Hey, here's the good news, folks. When the money system collapses and the paper dollars won't buy a loaf of bread for a wheelbarrow of them, then the problem goes away, right? You don't have to worry about using those nasty old dollars because they're worth less. Nobody will want them. Problem is, of course, that if we fail to take the right action when we had the chance, it's even worse. Are we still dealing falsely with the ones we purchased gold and silver from, is the question. And I would say no, because they know what they're doing. They got the real stuff. They're willing to trade it, aren't they? I know people that have been in that business for a long time. Now, what they're doing is they're working on the margin. The most of the gold and silver brokers that I've known personally, they may be swapping gold and silver for dollars, for paper, or for euros or whatever else. But believe me, they got a vault of their own, and they're taking what they're earning in the delta, in the profits, in the margins there, and they're putting it away in terms of real stuff. They're not saving in terms of the fake dollars. And that's really all I'm suggesting to you. Understand that when the system is judged, when the false God, the in God we trust of the almighty dollar, the full faith and credit of Big Brother, comes apart at the seams, and we're seeing it, then what? Do we have an option? If it's hard today, because I don't have the money to do this or that, I haven't got the money to buy silver, how much harder is it going to be when you don't have anything that you can even buy bread with? So, people make a hefty commission. I don't begrudge people that are doing the right thing the chance to earn a living in the process. So let's not sweat that. The point is, if you've got gold and silver at this point, I would certainly want more for it than the Wall Street Journal tells you the price of silver is. I've been making this point for a long time. It's not real silver. The price has been manipulated by criminals. The crooks at the COMEX and the London Bullion Metals Association and others, so that it's a lot cheaper than what it's really worth. You're going to pay a premium in fake dollars to buy something real. But again, the point here, and I'm not trying to give financial advice or anything else, what I'm suggesting is the following. We have been lied to. We've inherited lies from our fathers. And as we're looking out at the world and realizing that this darkness is falling and it's getting closer, and that so much of what the United States was, right? What did the advisors to Pharaoh say? Hey, can't you see it? Mitzrayim has been destroyed. We had the State of the Union message. And people that sat there and wasted their time watching the lying Cretan flap his lips. And I'm all of them, period, from Washington. Get up there and lie. The State of the Union is good. The economy is wonderful. Hey, if it gets any better, y'all are going to starve. When their lips are moving, they're lying. Let's go there. Let's do this just to make that point. Here's a piece from CNS News. The headline tells you the story. Obama in the State of the Union. Same-sex marriage is, quote, America at its best. You want a summary of America, the State of the Union in 2014 into 2015? Licensed, Big Brother approved abomination is, quote, America at its best. I guess it's even as good as, the only right to privacy that any American has. The right to commit licensed murder. How upside down, backwards, calling evil good and good evil do we need to get? I'll quote one more line from this abomination of a speech. The emperor-in-chief said, quote, I've seen something like gay marriage go from a wedge issue used to drive us apart to a story of freedom across our country, a civil right. That's as much as I can handle. I'm going to stop right there. In other words, a man lying with a man as with a woman, something that the scripture calls abomination, the strongest possible term in Hebrew, has now been reduced to a wedge issue used to drive us apart. I guess to a certain extent, if you understand it from the biblical perspective, that's true. It's a sharp double-edged sword dividing truth from lies. It is something that will divide people, those who believe in Him and those who serve another God. So as America goes, says the emperor-in-chief of America with a K, gay marriage is no longer a wedge issue used to drive us apart. Now it's a story of freedom. Folks, if the only freedom you've got left is to commit abomination before God and kill, well, so you don't have to worry about it if it's gay marriage, isn't that wonderful? Kill the outcome from those marriages that aren't quite so approved of by Big Brother. You're a worse slave than anybody that ever lived in Mitzrayim under the worst pharaoh you can imagine. From there we go to this. The emperor was lauded by so-called transgender lawyers and others, activists, because he had the chutzpah, they didn't use that term for crying out loud, to use words for the first time ever in a State of the Union message like lesbian, bisexual, and transgender. It was historic, said one of these cretins. I've already mentioned it last night. I've done the joke. You know, George Carlin, remember that? The seven words you cannot say on television? The S word, the F word, the MF word, and a bunch of other words? Isn't it special? Why, Obama could have just gone out and said the seven words. He could have gone down in history that way, too. Probably would have been less offensive to all of us and to the creator of the universe as well. Think about that for a minute. So, State of the Union, not so hot. By the way, if you liked Obamacare, just wait until the new national priority, which is child care. It's kind of like Obamacare 2.0 is unleashed. Yes, Big Brother wants to take care of our children collectively. I guess if they can inject them and inject you and decide that they cannot be taught certain things, why not? Just go the rest of the way and provide day care. It's kind of like Commie Corps all the way up and down the line. And think about this, too. Commie Corps has been introduced into the schools to turn the children into great little slaves of the state, proper indoctrination. I'll come to that in just a second here. And what we're doing now, what was the State of the Union saying? We're going to move it up and down scale. Going to move it down and pick up the little kiddies with Obamacare of a day version. And we're going to move it up and turn the so-called college situation, community colleges. If you thought that the education was worthless when it cost an arm and a leg, just wait. So you see what it is when it's free. Here's a piece from Whitehead, John Whitehead of the Ruthven Institute. Here is the dire state of the nation, what you won't hear from the politicians. Truth is that America, with a K, is imploding, and he lists several things. None of this is going to be a surprise, so we'll do it really fast. Our education system is abysmal. The United States spends more than most of the world on education, $115,000 per year per student. Did you hear that? $115,000 a year per student on average. We still rank number 36 in the world when it comes to, well, trivial things. Math, reading, and science. And instead we have Commie Corps indoctrination. Americans don't know their rights. They're ignorant about how government is supposed to operate. I'm going to suggest that goes right along with the following. Parents are no longer viewed as having an inherent right to raise their children as they see fit. They're being arrested for things like letting their kids out in the playground or walk to school alone. They're being charged with medical child abuse if they, for example, teach the Bible or any number of things. He's got links for so many of these things. Patrolled by police, the schools have become more, little more than quasi-prisons. Children as young as age 4 are being handcuffed in the public indoctrination centers for acting up. They're learning to be subjected to body searches and lockdowns and suspended for behaving, well, like a kid. I guess if you want to behave like a kid, you have to be in the Oval Office or in the Congress. Prisons, now housing the largest number of inmates in the world in America and the highest rate per capita, have become public-private partnerships, money-making enterprises for private corporations that rely on inmates for cheap labor. And interestingly enough, it turns out that you want to compete with Red China? Go to Red Prison State America, where the average inmate makes less than the lowest scum in the lowest slums of places like Singapore, Malaysia, Indonesia, and Shanghai. We've got the most expensive, least effective healthcare system in the world, once the best. Our homes, he says, provide little protection against government intrusions. Police agencies already empowered to crash through your door. We don't need no stinking warrant. Now have radars. As a matter of fact, these radars have been around for years. It's just that now they can be admitted openly, and the three-letter news agencies are talking about it. They can see through the walls of your home and check out what you're doing in bed and so forth. Want to talk about your right to privacy, ma'am? You're no longer innocent until proven guilty. In the present surveillance state, the burden of proof has now been shifted. People can be spied on without warrants, scanned, frisked, monitored, tracked, and treated as if they were all guilty of some or other wrongdoing because you're a criminal, you're a domestic terrorist, until you prove otherwise. And guess what? You can't prove otherwise. Private property. That includes your body, means little to nothing at a time when SWAT teams and other government agents can invade your home, break down your doors, kill your dog, wound or kill you, damage your furnishings, and terrorize your family without so much as a pretense of a warrant anymore. Oh, there's places I know, the occasional little exception that proves the rule, where they may still try for a warrant. But the worst of the abuses, we don't need that. Matter of fact, you can tune on the TV and you'll see CSI and NYPD. Is that still on NYPD Blue? That shows you how long it's been since I've watched TV. Anyway, any cop show that's going to show you how it is that the cops can say, "Did you hear something? I think I heard somebody yell, help, help. Yeah, let's break down the door. And if we see a dog, we'll kill him first. Is this the right door? Hey, who cares? We'll know when we get inside." Court rulings undermining the Fourth Amendment and justifying invasive strip searches now leave people powerless against police, empowered to forcefully draw blood, take DNA, strip search, and intimately probe anybody they want to. Men and women alike, the cases now are legion, are being subjected to essentially government-sanctioned police rape, even in the case of routine traffic stops. Americans can no longer therefore rely on the courts to mete out justice. Increasingly, they march in lockstep with the police state. This is just, a few of the things that he points out. Yes, police abuse is now, there is no protection. They're above the law. And Americans are powerless in the face of an increasingly militarized police force, too. So here's the real state of the union. People aren't hearing about it. And then they wonder why it is that a nation which no longer understands that there's a creator of the universe who delivered his people from bondage thousands of years ago in ancient Egypt, we're told, teach your children. Show them what happens when false gods rule a land. Show them what happens when Pharaoh believes himself to be a god. Show them what happens. Warn them about the plagues. Come out of her, my people, so that you don't participate in these things. Okay, here's a story from a guy that, I find interesting. When it comes to His foreign policy acumen, I give him high marks, as do a lot of folks. I'm talking about a fellow named Lyndon LaRouche. Some of you know LaRouche's, what was it? I forget. He used to have a global something or other news source. And he gave he gives pretty good G2 information on what's going on that scale. The problem, of course, is when it comes to economics, he's kind of an unabashed socialist. But he does say this: Wall Street is on the edge of another financial tsunami, and all of that is driving the world towards a general state of war. The latest provocations in Ukraine are serving as an immediate trigger for confrontation with Russia. Now, he focuses on what's going on there. As you probably know, too, we had the King Abdullah, 90-year-old fellow that was running Saudi Arabia, or at least the figurehead, passed this week. Now they got a young, spry fellow, 78 years old, taking his place. Not to worry, the oil situation isn't going to change because the CIA still is really right there in cahoots with whatever it is that the Saudis are doing. And what they are doing, of course, is pushing an Islamic state of their own flavor on the world with the U.S. It's hard to tell who's the cart and who's the horse there anymore. Meanwhile, in Israel, they got concerns about the northern border. They got concerns about an invasion from Iran, and things are escalating dramatically. In Syria, ISIS continues to advance on the one hand because they're doing the bidding of Washington, trained and armed. Occasionally, they'll drop arms to them on the one hand, while at the same time trying to bomb them and move them out of Iraq and into Syria. It's like if you've got this out-of-control force, and you want them to move in the direction you want, right? It's like an acid. You make sure you pour it towards Syria and not towards Iraq. In other words, the world is a mess. Back to LaRouche, because he makes this point. What's heading our way is a global thermonuclear showdown. Citibank was the latest Wall Street too big to fail and too big to jail bank to post some serious fourth quarter losses this week. As Wall Street banks were announcing 50,000 more layoffs halfway around the globe, the Ukrainian government was launching ever new provocations against Russia, meeting with top NATO generals and announcing a call to draft up to 100,000 new troops and launch a military offensive against its own citizens in the east of Ukraine. Russia, meanwhile, has made clear that while they're trying to push for a diplomatic solution, starting with an immediate ceasefire and resumption of talks with Kiev, they will not cave in to, quote, NATO blackmail. On Wednesday, Foreign Minister Lavrov and Putin spokesman Peskov both made clear that they understand these NATO actions are nothing short of an all-out campaign to overthrow Putin. Wouldn't it be neat? Well, never mind. That will be... I'm just thinking, wouldn't it be funny if Russia was making similar attempts, ha-ha, to overthrow the criminals in Washington? That'd be a significantly greater effort, I guess. Anyway, all of this kind of madness, says LaRouche, can only lead the world to thermonuclear extinction, literally, at virtually any moment. And meanwhile, Russia has boasted of boosting their strategic nuclear strike capability and announced a new military doctrine, making clear they understand the nature of the asymmetric assault on their current leadership. And interestingly, further, he says, Obama's Tuesday night State of the Union address contained a bunch of blatant provocations against both Russia and China, and his words did not go unnoticed in both Moscow and Beijing. So he's blunt and talks about some of these things. It's, you know, just another indication of where we are. At this week's World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the role of China in launching a new global economic paradigm is being openly admitted. China, of course, has been buying gold. So a lot of things coming down on this regard. Let's pause. I guess at this point what I want to do is we'll start to wrap up that aspect. I want to try to make this as clear as I can. You know, if you look at the whole picture today, I can understand why people would be rightfully afraid if they don't know the creator of the universe, if they don't know that He has warned us about all of this and made clear exactly what's coming. There's nothing that He hasn't done, that He hasn't declared through His servants, the prophets. We're seeing all of that play out, and I think it's increasingly obvious to those that have eyes to see. Now, the question, of course, is always, and this is why I focus on this come out of her, my people aspect, what do we do about it? Answer. Return to me. Teshuva. If you realize you've been going the wrong way, then go the right way. We've inherited lies from our fathers. We got all of these fellowships, churches, denominations, many of the licensed ones, right? The clergy response team sycophants out there preaching the Romans 13 lie. If Big Brother says jump, you say how high. That's how you serve God. They're just not telling you. It's not the God of the Bible. Because they're telling you that his law has been done away with. Right? Jesus died on the cross so you could have a ham sandwich. Chow down, bud. Don't worry about those plagues that come through pork. Just pray over it. It'll be okay. Lies built upon lies. We are at a place, folks, where we have to realize, you know what? If the God that they don't even tell you his name anymore. I guarantee you, most Sunday church people have never heard. They may have heard Jehovah because they've heard of something called Jehovah's Witnesses. That's about it. They don't know that in their Bibles, when it says capital L-O-R-D, that's not what's written. There's a line in, I think it's Isaiah, it actually appears several places in Scripture, about prophetic times in the future, when they shall all know that my name is the Lord. Come on! That's a pitifully horrible translation. They will know that my name is the Lord when they've replaced his name. The whole point of the book of Exodus is know that Ani Yahuwah, I am who I say I am. And by the way, is it how I pronounce the name that matters? No. What matters is the character that is literally oozing from, explained in graphic detail in every single story and word in the Torah, but especially in this book of Exodus. Why is he doing all of this stuff? Because he is who he says he is, and he wants us to know that, and he wants us to teach our children. And we haven't been taught. We've been lied to. We've inherited lies from our fathers. Folks, if you've got people, friends, loved ones that are going to a church that they're being told, don't keep the Passover. Now, can you keep it, by the way? No, let's not worry about that so much. In other words, don't even know about this stuff. That doesn't matter anymore. There's a problem here. Our father says it's important that we teach our children this stuff. We weren't taught it, and then we find out we got problems. We no longer know why it is that he says, Ani Yahuwah, because we don't have a clue. All of these things that he says, keep, do, forever, throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. When you get into the land, do this stuff especially. And if you don't, well, I'm going to end up kicking you out of the land. Well, we've been kicked out of the land. We're back in bondage. So now what? Well, because we're not in the land, there's a lot of things we can't do. Mark, great. Can we teach our children, for crying out loud? Can we at least tell the story? Even if they're too young to know what it means? Because we were lied to, does that mean we have to continue lying to folks? In other words, if we're not at least going through and reading and saying, hey, Father, what can I do? What can I, how can I honor you? This Passover time is coming up again. This is to be a beginning of months to us. I think I get that. It says in your word over and over again, Abba, Father, Ani Yahuwah, keep this as an ordinance forever. On the first day, there's to be a set apart, a holy convocation, the seventh day. What can I do, Father? How can I make this? How can I do something that's pleasing to you? Well, it starts with reading it, right? If you've never been taught what it is, at least read it. And for crying out loud, if somebody's lying to you and says it doesn't matter anymore, we got Christmas nowadays and Easter instead nowadays, ask them an easy, obvious question. If you really claim to honor this Messiah, then why the hell are you taking what he did that you say is the most important event in human history and renaming it after a pagan goddess that the book of the Word says over and over again is abomination to him? Somebody's lying. And with all due respect, O preacher man, I think it's you. We can read. Folks, we ought to be able to read. Even if we didn't get taught this when we were young, like we should have. And even if now we're suffering from it. And even if now we're asking ourselves questions, how can I come out of her? I don't know. How do I keep honest weights and measures? We can start with the really easy stuff. Just read. Teach your children the things that he says, hey, when they ask you this question, you're going to be able to answer them. Observe this thing as an ordinance to you and to your sons forever. when he gives you the land that he's promised, you shall keep the service. And it comes to pass. Oh, we failed on that score, right? So how do we get back, Father? When it comes to pass that your children say unto you, what do you mean by this service? Can we honestly say the following? It is the sacrifice of the Pesach of Yahuwah that he passed over the houses of the children of Egypt, of Israel in Egypt. He smote the Egyptians and delivered our houses. And the people bowed their head and worshipped. Can we begin to return to an understanding of who he is, of what his character is, of the things that he says? Right? I like the line from John 14:15. If you love me, if you claim you love me, keep my commandments. Mark 7:7, Luke 6:46, other places throughout the so-called New Testament where he says things like, why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do the things I say? Hey, you can argue about whether he's one or three or all of those things. The point is the word consistent? If we're honest, we'll have to say that it is. From Bereshit, from Genesis to maps, it's consistent. Do the things that I have told you to do. Teach your children. Keep this service in this month. Tell your son why we're doing this. By the way, it's not a Jewish thing. This is the feast of Yahuwah. We're doing this, son, because of what Yahuwah did for me when I came forth out of Egypt. Well, I wasn't there, Mark. Guess what? You are. Whether you know it or not, you're in a far worse place and a far greater bondage than arguably has ever been put on any man in human history. You've been surveilled in a way that Pharaoh couldn't begin to conceive of. Pharaoh just killed the firstborn male children. You live in a land where they license the killing of anybody, including you. No evidence required, no due process required, and they'll prattle about the rule of law. You want to talk about bondage? You can't even keep some guy with blue gloves from groping your gonads when you think you're going to get on a plane or a train or a bus. Talk about slavery? Those who falsely believe they're free, let them rattle their chains. Keep, hear, and do. Therefore, I'm reading chapter 13, verse 10. You are to keep and do, shamar, this ordinance in its season from year to year. Tell your sons, let this be a sign upon your hand and a memorial between your eyes, that the instruction, the Torah of Yahuwah may be in your mouth. For with a strong hand he brought you out of Egypt. Would you like to come out of this new Egypt? You want to come out of her? All of these things. Oh, some of this is really hard, Mark. I don't have enough money to buy silver. I don't think I can move out to the country. I don't think I can do this. I don't think I can do that. Oh, woe is me. Woe is me. How bad it is. I guess I'll just eat worms and die. Can you teach your children? Can you at least begin to study to show yourself approved and read and do what he says to do? If we can't do something really simple and straightforward, like keep his Sabbaths weekly, and then those that he says, hey, set this day aside. Just set it aside. Just study. Just guard it. Watch. Be ready. And then... don't worry about the rest of it, folks. If you're not willing to go, get up off your bohinkus, don't sweat the other stuff. Just take what comes. Because just like Pharaoh, we've earned it. All right, let's pause. Let's pause there. May talk a minute here about some of these distinctions. I think that what's really interesting about this whole thing is that there came a point at which, right, the people of Israel, those who were fixing to be delivered, began to defy Pharaoh. There was a distinction made. I don't think we're seeing the distinction made yet. I think in terms of the parallels, the bookends, we're a ways from when those distinctions get made. In other words, we're still suffering from the same plagues, probably because a lot of us don't even realize that we're in Egypt. But as we begin to do that, now there comes a time in which we have to choose. Choose this day whom you will serve. Are you going to serve Pharaoh? Or are you going to come out? Going to walk with those who are being delivered by his mighty hand? In a legal sense, this term is choice of law. You going to choose his Torah? Are you going to choose the law? If you know what it is, right? Hey, who knows how many volumes of IRS code and other things? You've heard the story, right? Average American commits 3 felonies per day. They don't even know it. Don't worry about it. They don't even need to convict you of a felony anymore to kill you. That's what you get when you serve Pharaoh. Pharaoh at least knew enough that he didn't so much, well, he killed the infants of the Hebrews, but he, by and large, you know, they were an economic resource for him. He didn't want to kill them all. He wasn't even willing to let them go. We got a place today where a lot of these leadership, what constitutes leadership in the world, they want to kill people. They're engineering plagues, viruses, all kinds of great ways to not only keep them in control, but kill those that get out of line. So I'm making this distinction, this understanding about choice of law. I think there's a lot that could be studied here. Here's one line that I'll mention. D.C. lawmakers are now looking to grant some immigrants that don't have U.S. citizenship the ability to vote in municipal elections. Isn't this funny? This is one of those little pieces of triviality that sneaks through in the news and shows you just how deep the rabbit hole goes. In other words, we're talking about privileges here. People wonder why it is you don't have a right to be free of illegal search and seizure, to keep and bear arms, to worship, to assemble, to speak freely, any of that kind of stuff. Answer, because you've traded your birthright for a cup of pottage. If you are a U.S. citizen, if you're a self-described taxpayer, if you do not object in a timely fashion when the slave master says you're a slave. Now they're talking openly about the Voting Rights Act of 2015, the local resident Voting Rights Act of 2015, allowing D.C. residents who are not U.S. citizens but meet the federal definitions to cast ballots in local elections. To gloss over a whole bunch of interesting stuff that I've talked about for years now, if you go read Article 1, Section 8, Clause 17 of the Constitution, about the Congress having the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. How's that for a grant of unlimited power? In the District of Columbia, you can see how this fits. You see? Because what's happened is, whether people know it or not, they have been determined to be denizens of the district. And when you claim to be a resident of Colorado or Wyoming or Oregon or wherever it may be, what that really means is a resident is somebody who is a sojourner, a stranger in a strange land, who lives somewhere else, is domiciled, to use the legal term, somewhere else. Like, I know, in that 10-square-mile district called Columbia, where Congress has the power to legislate in all cases whatsoever. In other words, they've given all of their God-given rights in exchange for whatever it is Congress says they are. Maybe they're licensed to kill and to commit abominations and call it marriage. All right, this is just one of those little things that helps illustrate the case. There is a whole different set of law out there, and people can volunteer into it. Here's another case, makes the same point. Tacoma, Washington, Dateline. A state bureaucracy is threatening a mother with removal of what she thought was her infant, unless the entire family subjects themselves to flu shots. Local TV KOMO News says the mother, Jamie Smith, doesn't want to put a flu vaccine because it has mercury and other kind of things. She doesn't like the side effects. She's worried about the effects on the brain. She's right on those scores. But the Department of Aktung Health and Services, Social and Health Services in Washington, is giving the family until February to comply, Aktung, or else you will bend over and you will take the vaccine, or we will take the youngest child. Ah, here's the rub. It was a foster infant, 2 weeks old. And the mother here, Mrs. Smith, is a dedicated foster mom. She's fostered 7 babies. She currently raises 5 of them, including an adopted 4-year-old daughter. Well, guess what? She made a deal with the devil, with the state anyway, when she adopted those children. They're not her children. The state giveth, the state can take away. And now the state is telling her, Big Brother gave you a baby. You don't do what we say, Obamacare lady, you. We're going to take away our child. So bend over, take one for the team. Same situation, folks. Essentially what we're talking about here, and this is the point I'm trying to make with the marriage, and we'll come back to the marriage situation in just a second. When you go to the state and you ask its permission, there are going to be strings attached. Let's talk about marriage. The creator of the universe gave us all the instruction we need about what it is that constitutes a marriage. You'll see, Genesis 2 and 3, where the separation of Chava or Eve from Adam is a special case, obviously. We don't have that one example, and afterwards things are a bit different. So the first time we get a full story and actually see somebody who's not already married, for example, Abraham, well, when we meet Abraham, he already has Sarai. But in the case of his son, Isaac, we get the whole story. We've talked about it fairly recently. There is a good and faithful servant who's not even named, who goes on behalf of his principal, Abraham the father, to find a wife for Isaac the son. He is given specific instructions. He acts as a representative, as an agent. He goes in the name of Abraham. He has his power of attorney. And literally, at the point where he finds the young woman, Rebecca, and he makes her an offer, and she accepts, Rebecca is married. She is betrothed. The marriage has not been consummated. Matter of fact, she hasn't even met the man that's going to be her husband, her covering. But when she gets on the camel and commits to going, it's a done deal. Then we see Genesis 24:67. I've read this many, many times before. I'm going to turn to it, and we'll read it again because people have been asking the question. This is something that comes up frequently. Turn with me if you will. Don't just believe me. You've got different versions. Read it and see what it says, because I, of course, will like to go to the Hebrew. Look at the Hebrew words. But we're turning to Genesis, then pages 24:67. I would have had this open if I had planned on reading this, but the question makes it required. Isaac's out in the field. Here comes the caravan. Rivka lifted her eyes. She sees Isaac. She gets off the camel. She'd asked the servant, "Who is this man walking to meet us?" The servant said, "It is my master." She took a veil. She covers herself. The servant, still unnamed, tells Isaac all the things that he had done. Now he knows who this woman is, as if he hadn't figured it out already. And Isaac, it says in verse 67, listen to the order and to the completion here. Isaac brought her into his mother Sarah's tent, and he took Rivka. The word in Hebrew is lechak. It literally means he consummated the relationship. He took her in that physical sense. And, are you ready for this? And she became his Isha, his wife. She's already made the agreement. There was offer and acceptance through the agency of the good and faithful servant on behalf of Abraham, Isaac's father. Now the marriage, already contractually agreed to, has been consummated, and she became his wife. Now get this. This is quite a turnaround, too, from America and indeed the Western world. And he loved her. I think the order is important. And he loved her. You want a simple definition of marriage? You're not going to find much more cogent and succinct one than this story leading to verse 67. The agreement is in place. Isaac brought her into his mother's tent. He consummated. He took Rivka, and she became his Isha. And he loved her. We're supposed to do all of that. But the order is important there too. All right, so let's repost the question if we can. Because the question has to do with divorce. And when I go through this, I'll try to do this briefly. Because we could talk about this literally for an hour, and I don't intend to do that. I contend that what we need to do really is focus on the marriage aspect. When we get that right, then we don't have to worry about the bad things that can happen because of the hardness of our hearts, if you will. We're not supposed to do the dissolution part, but there's a process here, a procedure that is in place just because we are nasty creatures. The human heart is desperately wicked. Who can know it? All that kind of stuff. When a man takes a wife and marries her, says Deuteronomy 24, and it happens that she finds no favor in his eyes because he's found something unclean in her, you could ask all kinds of questions. What is this? What is required, right? If she burns the toast, does that count? I'm not going to try to answer that. I'm just going to simply say, ideally, not just ideally, because we are, specifically as men, we are told, you make a covenant, you honor it. Those words come out of your lips, guys, you do. All that you have said, you will do. That's Numbers chapter 30. So don't give me the excuse. She burned the toast. I don't want to hear it. You made a covenant, you keep it. There was a contract. Isaac took her, and he loved her. That ought to be the end of it. So we're talking about people already that are in a place they shouldn't be. I guess that applies to most of America today. All right. She finds no favor in his eyes. He's found some uncleanness. What is he to do? Here's the process. He writes her a certificate of divorce. This is colloquially by a lot of rabbinic Judaism referred to as a get. In the Hebrew, it's sefer keretuta, a writing of divorcement. It's a written witness. He writes her this certificate, he puts it in her hand, and he shalaks her. He sends her, he puts her out of his house. Then what is the upshot of that? When she has departed his house, she may go and be another man's Isha. Okay, that puts to bed the whole issue of all of these so-called churches saying, oh, if she goes and gets divorced, she's a tainted woman, she can never remarry. That's a lie. It says, Scripture says, she's got the get, she may go and be another man's Isha. Now, if we have any doubts, it even tells us, it repeats almost word for word the same thing. If the second guy, if he too detests her, he also can put a sefer keretuta, certificate of divorce, in her hand, send her out of his house, and then it tells us that, hey, this first guy who's already shown he can't keep a deal and can't do what he had committed to do, and he had to release her from vows that he made, Numbers 30 again, he can't take her back. But what I'm going to contend, at least as far as the answer to the question about how does divorce work, is there you go. It requires those elements. There's something wrong. I will contend that no matter what's wrong, we ought to be honoring our covenants. Let's just leave it at that. But he writes her a certificate. He puts it in her hand. He sends her out of his house, and she may go and be another man's. Now, if you think about it, too, she has two witnesses. She's no longer a virgin. That's the essence of being married and consummated. But she, in fact, has two witnesses. Her witness and the witness that is in her hand via this certificate that says she may go and be another man's Isha. So the requirements, let everything be confirmed in the mouth of two or three witnesses, are there. All right, so let's go back to the question. Did it scroll off again? Okay. All right. Give me a timestamp.
11:27.
Okay. I'm going to have to keep scrolling on me. Okay, so there is, if there is not a legally recorded by man's marriage done, how does one... Okay, so let's just try to address several of these things. Legally recorded by man's. I'm going to contend to you, and this is what I'm contending, folks. If you go to Caesar or Pharaoh and say, oh, pretty please, Pharaoh, may I have your permission to execute a marriage so far as you are concerned? Hey, if I'm two guys, I can do this, right? And Pharaoh says, you betcha. Just sign here on the dotted line, right? Make the deal with the devil. Well, if you're signing up for Pharaoh's laws and making an agreement in accord with Pharaoh's laws, then by his permission, you better understand all the strings that are attached that Pharaoh's got. I'll suggest to you one of them is he owns the children. If you don't doubt that, just ask social services or the Department of Child whatever in almost every state. They'll tell you, we don't need a warrant. We've got your marriage license. The output of this legal arrangement is ours, belongs to the almighty state. We will decide how to raise the children. Oh, by the way, same thing goes for your licensed church, Mr. 501c3 pastor, or rabbi, or priest, or father. In for a penny, in for a pound. Who is the creator of the licensed church? Answer, read your certificate of incorporation. It's the state of Delaware or Colorado or whatever federal or other entity it is that claims the ability to be the creator. And it has strings attached. You'll obey the creator's laws. What the creator gives, the creator can take away. That's why a true, if you will, kahal, a gathering, an assembly of called out ones, has no other creator other than the real creator. Well, the same thing goes for marriage. What license do you need for marriage? Answer, you need permission of the fathers involved. When a woman is under her father's care, well, it's the father that has the veto power. You can find that in Deuteronomy 22 and all kinds of other places throughout Scripture. You see it in the story of Jacob and Dinah and the rape of Shechem, if that's indeed what it was. They need the father's permission. They knew that. But if you go to a different father, if you make a different deal in front of a different master, well, now you better have his permission, and you better obey his rules. So, there's a bunch of ways of looking at this. I think it boils down to the following. If you're a 501c3 church, and your master says you don't be dare preaching about a man lying with a man, there are certain verses that are just plain verboten. I don't want to hear you talking about dishonest weights and measures either. Now, you can preach Romans 13 all you want. That's the one that says, when Caesar says jump, you say, how high? Hey, that's fine. But don't tell us about all this other stuff. No, that's verboten. That's Old Testament probably anyway. Go ahead, get your Christmas tree and keep that, and don't worry about the rest. All right, same thing for marriage. You get your licensed marriage? Well, we're going to determine what's best for the children. We're going to know that if we need to check out what's in your bedroom, what's going on there, well, we got our x-ray machines, we can check it out. We're going to let you abort the ones that we don't want, that's okay. But beyond that, we'll let you know. And I guess I'll put it this way. What's interesting is, of course, if you do go get Caesar's license, people want to know, well, what about Caesar's divorce? Is it valid? Ask Caesar. Right? Shacked up with this woman, then we made it legal, then I went and got a divorce. Hey, I've had 6 of those, planning on number 7 here pretty soon. It's okay, I can have as many as I want as long as I do it sequentially. Same thing goes for guys, right? I can have as many of those too, just only one at a time. That's the way Caesar says, that's what we're going to do. You got Caesar's divorce? Did Caesar give you a certificate? Something you could put in her hand? Well, isn't it interesting? Okay, at least to that extent, Caesar's obeying Deuteronomy 24. All the elements are there. Writes the certificate, puts her out of the house. Now, of course, it's not his house to put her out of. Belongs to Caesar. Caesar will determine where the kids go and who gets the house and who gets the car and who gets all of Caesar's money. None of that should surprise us. In for a penny, in for a pound. But it meets the requirements. Caesar's marriage, Caesar's divorce. And at that point, I guess I would suggest someone can do it right the next time. Okay, so if a couple is married by man's legal systems, are they really married in Yah's eyes? I'm gonna say I don't know the answer to that. I will suggest this, however. Now, by doing this, I'm going to give a little bit more detail on what I just said. I'm going to suggest to you there's a whole lot of people that are married that have no clue that they're married. You know, I've been living in sin with this woman for 20 years. Do you honor her? Do you have an agreement with her? Are you providing? Are you doing the things that Scripture says you're supposed to do? Do you love her? Does she respect you? I could care less about the license. Because we've already determined what it is that is required for a marriage in the eyes of Yah. And basically, it's offer and acceptance and consummation. You got those three things? Forget the rest. Understand. Now, that means there's a whole lot of adultery and other things going on out there too. So, as you know, so the question from Tirza having to do with is somebody married in Yah's eyes? Well, there are a whole lot of people that will deny the existence of that God. Or that what they're doing matters in his eyes or anything of the sort, right? They're just playing outside his system. They're serving another master entirely. There are people, and I know there are people that will argue and say, I've got parents, for example. I'm sure you know all kinds of other people that would say the same thing. You got to make it legal. Why? What do you get by doing that other than encumbered by us? Oh, you get your tax benefits. Well, isn't that special? You get your ability to have various kinds of, all kinds of benefits from Caesar's system. Isn't that special? Can I live without that stuff? Had I better learn to live without that stuff because of the strings attached? What does it involve as I come out of her? I'm talking about a whole great big legal morass and just suggesting to you this. If you hear the word license, permission from a competent authority to do that which, as a peon, as a feudal serf, you are not otherwise allowed to do. If you hear the word license, read the fine print. Check for the strings attached. You're going to find out that if you have God-given rights to keep and bear arms, to freely speak, to worship, to marry, you don't need Caesar's permission. But if you get it, ask yourself what else came along with it that you didn't know about. And you may find out the answer the hard way again when Caesar comes to take his children back. So, from Kurtz, I think this is the last of the series. If a person is married by the laws of man and or then divorced by man's laws, does Yah see the couple as being married and now divorced? Okay, I'm not going to claim to speak for Yah, but what I will do, and I'm trying to be consistent in this, is to say, let's just read Scripture again. And what does it say? It says, when a man takes a wife and marries her. Interesting. What does that mean? When a man takes a wife and marries her, and then there's this reason that they're going to split. There's something unclean going on. There's a procedure, a process. We've read it. He writes a certificate of divorce. He puts it in her hand. He sends her out of his house. Has that happened? So the question, I think, is answered specifically by the quote. If someone has been married by man's laws and then divorced by man's laws, well, if it meets those requirements, they're separated. There has been a certificate of divorce. She's no longer in his house. Are they quote-unquote divorced? Can she go and be another man's Isha? The answer, that's the key, right? She wants to go be another man's. Can she? Answer, yes. Now, Barek asks the question about, is her father okay with the shake-up, the chains detached? I think in the context here, the way that I've usually tried to explain this is my connection of the dots. If you read Numbers 30 and add all the issues about vows and a daughter who's in her father's house. And I believe, the way I read Numbers 30, is that a daughter living under her father's authority in her father's house, her vows are subject to her father's veto. He literally, on the day that he hears it, he can veto the vow. He can say, my daughter, that will not stand. He can cast it down. That would include her having gone out and shacked up with another guy and saying, I'm going to make a vow to him. The father has the authority to veto that vow on the day that he hears about it. If he doesn't veto it, it'll stand, says Numbers 30. So the way I read this is my dot connection, is that what happens, and it can happen at a ceremony. I got no problem with a ceremony. I do have a problem with the words, now by the authority vested in me by the state of Nevada, I declare you man. And I could care less about the authority of the state of Nevada. I care about the authority of Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and him alone. All right, so with that exception, I have no problem with the ceremony or with this exchange of vows being made before witnesses. A lot of times people need that. Now, we ought to be able to just keep our vows because we know that we said certain things and that we meant it. That should be enough. But for the same reason that divorce seems to be permitted, we got lots of liars running around nowadays of both sexes that can't keep their vows. But back to the father. The father has this veto authority. On the day that he essentially gives that authority to the son-in-law, that's what's happening. It's a transfer of authority over the vows of the woman. It was the daughter, now she is the Isha, the wife, and it is the husband that has authority over her vows. Up until when? up until the point where the husband abdicates that authority, writes her a certificate of divorce, a get, and puts it in her hand. Now, we can go back to Numbers 30, she is on her own. She's now responsible for her own vows. She has the witness. If she then chooses to place herself under the authority of another husband, great, he has authority over her vows. Again, Numbers 30. So it's very nice and very consistent if we'll read what the Torah, the law, actually says. And it gets messed up, in other words, when we start thinking that men have the power and the authority to rewrite, to add to and subtract from, that's forbidden, what Yah has written. Okay, so we got other questions on that score. Hopefully, I think I get it now, comment there, so that's good. Are there any others that I missed? Are there any from the other room, by the way, too? Because I cannot see the Talking Torah chat room. So if there are, somebody can scan those across for me and put them here in the Pal Talk room. I'd appreciate it. All right, this is a really tough one. I'm not sure if we've got less than an hour. One more question on this. In Yah's eyes, is there any time that he says a wife should leave her marriage? Now, I can quote you to the Midrash that Paul gives. I think it's in 1 Corinthians 7. And I think the Midrash, if we understand it in the context of Torah, is a good one. Okay? Whether we have an adequate translation, there's always questions there. So the answer, study to show yourself approved, see if these things fit. Paul says a wife should not leave her husband. And then he goes on to say in the very next line, but if she does, she better remain unmarried, because if she hasn't got that get, she's still a wife, right? So it's that simple. So here's the question. Are there places and times when a woman needs to leave? Certainly. Because the Torah also tells us to choose life. Okay, I'm not going to hesitate to say there's an obvious, easy case. If a woman realizes that by staying in a house with a man, she may get killed, well, she is literally supposed to choose life. She better choose to live. And, of course, there's all kinds of other things. Now we're talking about a place where it's murky. Maybe the guy was never an obedient kind of person that she should have been, quote-unquote, shacked up with or licensed to or any of the kind of thing anyway. We end up with a whole bunch of problems, in other words, when we, just like we are today, when we've gone so far from the law, the instruction of Torah, that we don't know right from wrong anymore. And it gets really hard to get back. We can make a real royal mess out of things. All right, how many wives, how many adulteries does the average teenager have in America before they hit 20 years old? Who knows? But I guarantee you, it's a mess. How do you sort all that out? Well, it starts with teshuva, with turning around. And so I see the comment about no more. I'm not quoting the New Testament. I'm quoting Midrash. I'm just telling you the answer is simple. A woman who can go and be another man's Isha will have a certificate, a get. If she does not have the certificate, the witness of the husband, even if he's a scumbag, she still has a living husband. She ought to go ask for the get. The scumbag will probably give it to her, especially if he doesn't, you know, who knows? Maybe he's just a controlling blankety blank. There's a problem if you go back and you study the history of the of rabbinical Judaism. You'll see that this has been a problem throughout the history of Orthodox Judaism. The term, as I recall, is aguna, or chained. It's a woman who would appear to be divorced or widowed, but does not have a get. Perhaps it was a man that went away to war and was missing in action, never returned. Some of you may know that's part of the reason why there was a tradition that men going off to war would literally give their wives a get just in case, so she wouldn't become an aguna. Anyway, the idea is that the get, or the sefer kruatuta, is necessary in order to enable remarriage. What about a woman whose husband turns to homosexuality? What about all kinds of other things? Again, we can get ourselves into a melaveches by, well, entering into contracts and covenants and sexual liaisons with people that we should not be getting into those kind of things with. I think probably now you see why it's so important that Abraham sent his servant to go find the right Isha for Isaac. He knew how important this was. So I'm not going to tell you that I know the answer for every situation. Do not, you know, women, do not allow yourself to be abused or killed. That's clearly wrong. It's clearly a violation of Torah. Don't allow yourself to be in a position of getting diseases or all those kind of things. But do understand that just to go and leave, while it might be the right answer to save your life, means that the problem is not yet solved until there's a get in hand, particularly if a woman wants to go and remarry. She owes it to the future husband. And he, if he is a Torah observant believer, will ask, okay, hey, I see you, and you seem like a wonderful woman. But I know, on the other hand, that let everything be confirmed in the mouth of two or more witnesses means I need to ask, have you got a get? Can you show me the written witness of the man that was your covering before? That says that I can now take you and not be guilty of adultery. So all of these things are important. I like the way Kevin puts it nicely. A man or woman should never leave the person they've made an agreement with. It's not the license that consummates the relationship. It's the sexual union that does, following the offer and the acceptance. And that's the part that is a little shocking to most of us. We're told, hey, you can take a test drive. You can do all this kind of stuff. Try her out for 6 months. Drive around the block a few times. See if you're compatible. And if you're not, there's plenty more out there. Go fishing some more. Those are all lies, and we've reaped the bitter harvest of that, to the point now where we think that a license can allow something that the Creator calls an abomination to be somehow just as good, and it's not. All it really does is just show us how far gone that thing is that we need to come out of. So that's the question. There's all kinds of other things. I'm gonna answer the other questions just this way. You know, should a woman leave if this is the case or if that's the case? Ideally, folks, when the covenant is made, that's it. We honor our agreements, men and women. Period. A man takes a wife. He ought to love her. He ought to take care of her. Period. He should never put her away. The reason this is here, and I do think this is a great quote, it's because of the hardness of our hearts. Shouldn't ought to happen. But it does. It's the same, you know, my line from when it comes to that. Well, you know, why is the Torah longer than three chapters? Genesis chapter 3. And they lived happily ever after, walking in obedience to their Creator. That should be it. The reason why there's another 1,000 pages of book is because of the hardness of our hearts, because we can't keep our agreements. Because we don't do what we ought to be doing. And there's all kinds of examples and exceptions and if-then clauses because of the fact that we have messed up. But in every case, you know, to the answer of all these questions, well, what about if this happens, what if that happens, is we get on our knees before our Creator and we make teshuva, we repent. Here's where I am today, Father. I don't even know how I got here. What a mess. What can I do now? Obviously, I come to you. I tell you I'm sorry, and I'm going to do better, and I'm going to study to show myself approved, and I'm going to walk in obedience to you from here on out. How do I do that? How do I make this right? And sometimes we don't necessarily want to hear the answer. What I'm going to suggest now as we start to wrap all this up is there is another bigger key here, because we get the same question. How can I come out of her? Same problem, right? We've made a deal with the devil. Think of it this way. What is the process of coming out of a Caesar system or a Pharaoh system like? Answer, we have literally had sex with the gods of this world. I'll put it really in a crass sense. You've made a deal with the devil. Called yourself a taxpayer, a U.S. citizen, a slave of the state. Got a license to keep and bear arms. Don't have to have that if we actually had a supreme law. Got a license to bear children with the state's blessing. They're going to take their piece of flesh. Got all these wonderful licenses. Now I'm in a... I want out. I realize that the money that I'm using isn't even real money, for crying out loud. It's a lie. It doesn't fit the Constitution. How'd that happen? I'm a slave, Father. Cry out. What do? Come out of her. Separate. Touch not the unclean thing. Can you get him to give you a get? Hey, guarantee you, Pharaoh ain't going to give you a get. Not until he's been, run through the ringer, like what we see in this book here. We may live to see that. But I will contend that we're at a different place in history, too. We're in a place in history when people are beginning to wake up and say, okay, I should not have been sleeping with the state. I shouldn't have let them into my, well, literally my pants if I've been to an airport. I shouldn't have let them own my children and take my children away. I shouldn't have let them take my God-given rights away from me in exchange for civil liberties and other little permissions as long as I'm a good little slave of the state. I should not have done this. I should not have done that. I shouldn't have made this deal. Now what? Come out of her. Touch not the unclean thing. It begins with repentance. We're on the wrong road. We know it. It's painfully obvious. We can see the destruction. The darkness is coming. Turn around. Go the other direction. Return to him. Oh, you can't obey two masters. Time to quit listening to Pharaoh. Start obeying the creator of the universe. He'll show you. He's written his word. I started this by saying we've got all these preachers talking about liberty and how, oh, we got to preach about the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, and abortion and all that kind of stuff, but they won't touch other things in a lot of cases. We don't want to see what the Bible really says. We still want to try to keep to this lie that it's done away with, all that old stuff in certain cases. Or, you know, in the case of the rabbinic Judaism, well, there's all this new stuff. It doesn't apply anymore. And we've got burdens upon burdens that we've added to the law. 1,000, well, more than that, rules for how to keep Sabbath and what you can do and what you can wear and how far you can walk. Any way you slice it, folks. Got lots of people wanting to be masters out there. And we need to learn to serve Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh and him alone and to return to him. Again, what I want to try to say when you put all this together is we can see the darkness coming. I think the plagues are increasingly obvious. And it should be clear that we need to come out of certain things and that that begins with some of the really simple stuff. If it seems too complicated to deal with, how do I make right a situation where I don't know how many times I've been married or divorced or committed adultery or whatever it is, and I don't know what's happening with all the licenses, and I don't know what agreements I've made that I've been bound to that I don't even remember. Well, what can I do? I can return. I can make teshuva. I can get on my knees before the Creator. I can ask for direction. I can study His Word, and I can start doing the things that I should have been doing all along that I haven't been, like teaching my children about the real feasts of Yah. They're not Jewish feasts. They're not pagan feasts. They're His. He says to do, to keep, to obey, to honor those things that He says to do, well, throughout our generations, wherever we may be. We can do that. We may not be able to do it exactly the same way that it was done the first time or that it would be done if we were in the land, but we can at least show our Father that we're trying. And we can begin to ask him the questions about how do we go the rest of the way? How do we separate ourselves? How do we begin to deal honestly with our brothers? Teach me. Study to show yourself approved. I like the line from Proverbs. It is to the glory of God to hide a thing and to the honor of kings to search it out. Well, we need to be doing that. We need to be searching things out and starting to get right, to teach our children. And, if we think we maybe have licensed our children to another God, hey, all the better to start sooner. Because as things get really, really tough, and they're getting tough fast, the time to make those distinctions is now. All right, we're almost at the top of the hour, so let me do this. I'm going to pray briefly, and then we'll do the Aaronic blessing, because I know we haven't heard that yet today. Abba, Father, Yehuah Eloheinu, Yehuah Echad, Yehuah Vitzivenu, Yehuah Nisi, Yehuah Rapha. We come before you. We pray that you would heal our backslidings. Show us your truth. Give us eyes to see and ears to hear. Help us to be doing the things you would have us do. Father, if we've made agreements that we shouldn't ought to have made, help us. Give us a get, or at least get Pharaoh to give us a get. Help us to do what we need to do. Let's start walking in obedience to you. Show us. Make the path straight, Father. Help us to veer neither to the right nor to the left. We have loved ones. We have children. We have others who are walking in rebellion. Help us to teach them what we should have been teaching them all along. If we can't talk to them directly because they won't listen or they're not where we need them to be, Father, give them witnesses. Turn them from that path that leads in the way of death. Bring our communities, our families, our houses together. Help us to be good and faithful servants. We thank you, Father. We praise you. Protect us through what lies ahead. Help us to be counted worthy to escape the things that are so clearly on the horizon, to be where we need to be. We thank you. We praise you. All of this we ask in your name. Hallelujah. And finally, remember that Yahuwah spoke to Moshe and to Aaron and said, here is how you are to bless the children of Israel. Say to them, Yivarekaka Yahuwah Varishmareka Yair Yahuwah Panavaleka Vichonecha Isa Yahuwah Penavaleka Viasim Lecha Ha Shalom. May Yahuwah bless you and keep you. May Yahuwah make his face to shine upon you. May Yahuwah lift up his countenance upon you and give you his shalom. Amen. Thank you, folks. Shabbat shalom.